Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, we'll reach in there, we'll pull the baby out, clip the cord, but not in a creepy way.
Oh no. That's creepy just hearing it.
Awkward.
Okay, well...
I have a lot.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, welcome. This is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight, after some housekeeping, we're going to talk about the 2007 movie The Kingdom, directed by Peter Berg, produced by Michael Mann.
A fact either I'd never knew or had forgotten. So this wasn't like a sneaky way to get another Michael Mann movie. Either.
Well, I was wondering, I'm seeing all these familiar faces thinking, wait, hold on. Now I know why I'm watching this movie.
Yeah, indeed.
So, but you said you have some housekeeping.
I do. I've been catching up on all your podcasts with you and Jason, and things keep popping up. I'm sure you have this experience when you're listening to other people, where you like want to interject yourself, but you know they can't hear you. I had a few of those listening to you and Jason talk about your last few movies. So I took some notes so I wouldn't forget. I'm so old now, I have no idea what my first note means. I'm hoping it's not like an iPhone autocorrect, because then I'll have no hope. But I typed in ultraviolet.
Oh, yeah.
Does that mean anything to you?
Yes, it does. Yep, because it comes from The Talented Mr. Ripley, and the guy who plays Peter was in the BBC miniseries or series, six episode series, Ultraviolet.
Yes. Okay, I remember now. Yeah. I remember because I was happy you mentioned it. I've seen that series. I really liked it. It had a very young Stringer Bell in it and a pre True Blood Stephen Moyer.
And it had some really clever plots. There's one in particular that I don't even want to give away. But they just have a way of dealing with a certain issue and how it corresponds with the vampirism they're dealing with, which is just so clever.
Yeah, it was my first introduction to like the BBC like six episode season. And it's great. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Sandy turned me onto it, and yeah, it's perfect because they knew what they had. They had six episodes to work with. That's all they were going to do. I guess if it became a smash hit, they could do another series. But this was all it was intended to be, and so they buttoned up the story.
Have you seen Luther?
I have not, although I've heard only good things.
Yeah, it's great. They even go, the first season was such a success that, you know, they wanted to do more, but Idris Elba was in demand, so... I think both the second and third series, I don't think they call them seasons, are only four episodes, which worked just as well.
Well, it makes it less daunting to just jump into.
But, yeah, there was another, so I was looking for a second season, Ultraviolet. I don't think they ever made one.
No.
There was another series. It was kind of campy, but it was better than I expected it to be, called Jekyll. It was about a six-episode series. Sort of a modern-day take on Jekyll and Hyde. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I've seen that. I think it's on my Netflix queue. I haven't watched it, obviously.
I recommend it.
Excellent.
Yeah, Ultraviolet. That's, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I just gave it to your mom to put on her iPad so she can watch it.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Another thing I had was, you mentioned a quote from Dark Knight Rises, but you never actually said the quote. And that was driving me nuts.
I'm sorry. Well, I didn't want to, because he hasn't seen it, I don't think. I think I just let it trail off, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. So, but go ahead, say the quote.
I don't know the quote you're talking about.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
That's why it's driving me nuts.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay, no. It's because Doug Benson did his Bane impression, like, on and on and on for a while on his podcast, which Doug Loves Movies, by the way, which I hardly ever watch or listen to anymore. But I just, you know, I learned about so many good comedians from that. Anyway, it's the quote in the very beginning of the stadium scene where the little boy is singing. And Bane says, like, he just stops, like, I think he's marching down the tunnel to get into the stadium or something. And he talks about how...
That's a lovely, lovely voice.
And then he basically orders the attack on the stadium. Or the bombings or whatever it happens.
I would not have guessed that.
Yeah. No, that was it. That's all.
Oh, I have an exciting present for you. I actually just found it tonight, like less than 90 minutes ago.
Oh,
I found Postal.
Get out of town.
Nope. It was I'm trying to unclutter my house, so I'm taking a bunch of old CDs and movies to Tidal Wave, and I found Postal in a box of old audio CDs. So I don't know if it'll still even run on our current software.
Is it a PC game or a Mac game or?
So both.
Oh, I wonder. Is it like Windows 3.1 or is it?
Windows 95.
95. You know what? I bet you could do it. I bet you just do it under compatibility mode.
I'm gonna pop it in right now while we're talking.
Yeah. It's like 8-bit heaven, man.
I thought you'd be happy about that. Also, going back to Clue, you and Jason are talking about Jane Wiedlin having a cameo.
Yes.
And then you were wondering why she was famous.
Yes.
And you guys both kind of talked around her, but you never quite got there. She was the guitarist for the Go-Go's.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that. That's why I didn't go there. Oh, yeah. By the way, we got our first non-Anderson feedback.
Sweet.
Yeah, well, it is sweet. However, it's not somebody who's never been on the show before. It came from T in Minnesota. And his feedback was that he was looking forward to the Clue episode, and he was a little shocked to find out that we mostly talked about murder by death in the Clue episode. Which is like, that's an excellent point. And for his trouble, I'm sending him my DVD copy of Clue. Since he couldn't get enough. But it's awesome. The feedback hotline, though, is open if anybody wants to leave a message.
Is that how he left the feedback?
No, I wish. I could just drop it in then. No, we had to... I didn't even read it word for word. I just said it, and Jason reacted to it as well. But drunk dials are welcome, too. I don't encourage anybody to drink, but if you happen to be drunk and are listening to our podcast, which I would maybe argue is a good way if you're, you know, into that. Maybe not.
Maybe not. But hey, feedback is good.
I love feedback.
You and Jason have also talked quite a bit about his time working at the theater. And I just wanted to chime in about how great that was for my movie watching habits, since he could put us on the list to go see movies for free, as long as, I think after like the first week or so that they've been out.
Oh, yeah.
And you and I saw so many movies that way, including Hardware, which you've mentioned a couple times.
Yes, Hardware. Oh, what a great... well, again, I haven't revisited it in a long time. It could be a Nightbreed, but again, stylistically, it was so great.
I watched part of it relatively recently. It was actually on cable. And it was a much weirder movie than I remembered.
Yeah, it's a strange movie.
Yeah, but there were, we could talk about Hardware some other time, but whenever you and Jason talk about him working in theater, I always remember some of the other benefits, like being able to snag some awesome movie posters, like the big, huge coming soon posters.
Oh yeah,
those are pretty great to decorate, like a really early teenage bedroom.
Oh, how about the Val Kilmer Doors banner?
That was pretty great. I'm assuming it's still around somewhere.
I think so. I think it's in your parents' workout room.
Yeah, your old bedroom and then my old bedroom.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite benefits to Jason working at the theater was every so often he would bring home a giant garbage bag, like the big, like 32 gallon size garbage bag full of popcorn. God, it's great. Yeah, I just keep that thing in my bedroom and like go to town on it for like a week.
Yeah. I always recommend people to have a brother that works at a theater. Like, I don't think I would really want to work at a theater, but I would love to have a family member who worked at a theater. I would highly encourage my daughter to work at a theater.
Yeah, it was great. I'm so happy he worked there.
Yeah, me too. It was a good job, too. I mean, you know, he got a lot out of it. It was awesome. At least from my perspective, it was. I also, another thing I remember from it, and we should be talking to him about this at some point, but although I think he'll like listening to this part of it. I also remember, maybe I was still living there for part of the time, but I was in and out of the house all the time. But I remember every 3 or 4 months he had to buy a new pair of shoes because whatever they use, a combination of the cleaners they use for the floor and the grease they use for the popcorn would put chemical holes in his shoes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, like melted the soles of his shoes, which is fantastic.
On the midnight showing of new releases for family members. Every once in a while?
Yeah, I remember we saw Back to the Future 2 and 3 in consecutive Thanksgivings, I think.
I think it was the same year, right? I thought it was like Thanksgiving and then Christmas.
No, because I think they were first run movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Didn't they come out really close together?
Oh, I don't know, maybe. Yeah, if so, yeah, I remember being there for both of them.
Yeah, also Terminator 2, and I think we saw that with Nancy's husband.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
And Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes. Oh, we just saw so many movies. That was awesome. That was a good time.
Yeah, maybe we can talk Jason into moving back up here and working for a theater again.
I think it'll be easier to get him to do the first than the second.
Probably.
Yeah. But no, let me tell you, as soon as Journey's old enough to work in the theater, man, I'm sending her that way. If they have movie theaters then.
You guys also talked about the Pope Must Diet.
Yes.
You were talking about that, and you're talking about Robbie Coltrane.
Yes.
Neither one of you could pull up what he was most famous for.
Okay.
He's Hagrid from the Harry Potter movies.
Ah, see, because I don't think either one of us have seen the Harry Potter movies.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, so at least I haven't seen him.
That's his retirement money right there.
Oh, well, yeah.
But I remember from the old Siskel and Ebert days, them talking about the Pope Must Diet, and it was the studio made them rename the movie because it was originally called The Pope Must Die.
Oh, get that down. That's so funny.
But they were afraid of backlash by the religious folks. So the studio wouldn't actually let them call a movie The Pope Must Die. So they added that T on.
Well,
I think has no bearing on the plot of the movie at all.
That's funny and weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have never seen the movie. Is it worth watching?
I've never seen it.
Oh,
I just remember that from Siskel and Ebert. So I may have some of my facts wrong, but the T is definitely just a sort of non sequitur add on.
Well, I did. We released the Stigmata episode today, and I was editing it. And I realized in the notes, I had actually put in the notes, a link to the story about the Pope stealing the rosary or the cross, because I had gotten it mostly right, but I felt like I had to put some backing to the story in case anybody thinks I was just making crap up. And I also put a mea culpa because when I painted the entire Norwegian people as a bunch of racists. When what I meant to say was that it was the right wing Norwegians who are racist. So it's like, I don't really want to get into the religious conversations, even about a religious movie, because it's just too tempting. That's the problem, is that if anybody really wants to fight, I'm still kind of happy to fight about it, but I realize that it's not worth it these days. At all. Okay, ever. Sure. Yeah, so. Yep, don't fight about religion. There's no winners. No.
All right, I've got two more quick things for you. And okay. We'll talk about the kingdom. You and Jay started talking about Kevin Costner movie.
Yes.
And neither one of you mentioned Mr. Brooks.
I have never seen Mr. Brooks, no.
The movie's got some problems. Probably the biggest one is that Dane Cook plays a prominent part in it.
The much maligned Dane Cook.
But it's got a brilliant performance by William Hurt in it. So I think Mr. Brooks is worth watching.
Okay, I will add it to my list, Mr. Brooks. Let me interject before you get to that last thing.
Yep.
In the Stigmata episode, I also put a link to what I was talking about, the comedy film nerds who were talking about real people getting killed during the Planes movie. Well, I was wrong. What he's talking about is that I guess there's some sort of old warplane character that tells a story at the end where a whole bunch of planes die.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what he was talking about. And it was Dave Anthony, and I put a link to his review because the review is hilarious and scathing. And it also rags on Dane Cook for being the voice of the Dusty, the crop plane.
Nah, I didn't think the movie was that bad.
He did. It's actually very entertaining reading, but it's a diatribe is what it is. It's a Dave Anthony sort of thing, because he's funny, but he does rants.
The last thing I had for you was you and Jason were doing your thing where you talk about who else could play the role. When you're talking about Tom Ripley.
Oh, yes.
And he brought up Ethan Hawke.
Yes.
Ethan Hawke has played that role.
Really?
Well, not Tom Ripley, but in the Angelina Jolie movie, Taking Lives, he played a serial killer who...
Spoiler alert!
This is a total spoiler if you haven't seen it, so sorry. Plays a serial killer who assumes the identities of his victims.
Have I seen that movie?
Very similar.
Is it worth seeing?
No.
Okay.
No, I think that was a paycheck movie for Ethan Hawke, so he could go back to doing Linklater. So.
Have you seen Sinister? Okay. I won't make us watch it, but it's interesting. It's an interesting horror movie. It's got one problem that took me out of it from the very beginning, and that's in a small role. Fred Thompson is a cop, and I just can't take Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson was, you know him probably from Law and Order, or from being a senator, or from running for president.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of took me out of it, but it's a creepy little movie. Makes no real sense. I mean, you know, but it's a creepy little movie. Okay, are you ready for the kingdom?
Yeah, I've been ready. I'll just stop. Yeah.
No. I want you to gush because I didn't know what to expect in this movie, and I was pleasantly surprised. Well, I guess surprised is the wrong word. I mean, I thought the performances were great, and we'll talk about them individually. But this was not the movie I was expecting it to be.
I hope in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe I'm guessing that that's the point.
I think so. I'm guessing a very similar experience the first time I saw it. And the first time I watched it, when it was over, it was just sort of, I was just sitting there like, holy shit, what just happened?
Yeah, exactly. That was my experience. Exactly.
And I never... I've thought about that movie a lot because I think it did so many brilliant things, but I never went back and rewatched it. until this week. And it still really holds up, even though you know what to expect. I think it's actually two different movies. I think the last 30 minutes is an entirely separate movie. Not separate movie, but different type of movie than the first part. And I think they execute both types of movies extraordinarily well. So I was, I was on track to do my normal 20 to 25 minute at a time on my iPhone at night schedule to get through the movie. But over the weekend, since I didn't have to get up super early for work, I ended up blowing through the entire first part of the movie in one night. So I ended up turning it off at, I think, like 1:30 in the morning, right before the event happened, to flip it into a different type of movie, because I knew what was coming and I didn't want to watch that while I was tired. But I couldn't stop watching the first part of the movie. It was so great.
So shall we dive into the plot a little bit?
Yes, we should.
Okay. I know you just are raring to go, which is awesome. So what we have here is during a softball game at an American Oil Company housing compound in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Al-Qaeda terrorists do a terrorist attack. One team hijacks a car and shoots residents, which forces the sort of the people in the softball game and people to flee in another direction. And in that direction is where a suicide bomber blows himself up, killing a whole bunch of people near him. Now, this causes the FBI legal attaché in Saudi Arabia, Special Agent Fran Manner, who's played by Kyle Chandler from Friday Night Lights, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He calls Special Agent Ronald Fleury, Jamie Foxx, to advise him about the attack. And I think what has happened, does it happen while he's on the phone?
It does.
Okay. While he's on the phone telling Jamie Foxx he needs to suit up and get there, or to mount up and get ready, a third bomb goes off, or a second bomb goes off, basically figuring out that this is about, the first attack was just to draw in first responders, and the second attack is to kill the first responders. So it's a special kind of evil.
Right. And in the opening credits of the movie, it established that the FBI is the investigating agency for, I forget how they frame it, for all American deaths all over the world, right?
Yeah, or at least all American deaths as a result of terror attacks all around the world.
Yeah. Which I didn't know.
Yeah.
I still don't know if that's true. I assume it is.
Well, it's weird. After 9/11, you've got everybody from the New York Police Department going overseas and fighting terrorists to, the FBI, who never really set foot out of the United States, as far as I knew,
mm-hmm.
to, of course, the CIA and all those NSA, probably agencies we don't even know about.
Yeah, so the setup is now you have Agent Fleury and his team. They have a personal stake in finding the people responsible for this, because Agent Manner was very close to all of them on this team. So they want to go over there and investigate. But maybe this is a good time to ask you, what type of movie were you expecting?
I was sort of expecting a going over to kill terrorist movie. And then when I realized that what we're dealing with was an investigative team, I wasn't sure what we were getting into. Because I thought it was going to basically be a shoot 'em up. And while there's some chase scenes in it, it's not quite that kind of a movie. What I also didn't expect was that one of the main characters in the movie was going to be a Saudi Arabian police. Was he military?
He was police.
Oh, colonel, yeah, in the police department.
Yeah, I don't know what exactly where the line was drawn between police and military in Saudi Arabia, but he was definitely at odds with the military general who was initially put in charge of the investigation.
Yeah, it looks like he's the commander of the Saudi State Police Force that's providing security at the compound.
Yeah, Al Ghazi. He was great.
Oh, no, he was fantastic. That actor just, he acted the crap out of that role.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I thought everybody did a good job, but okay, so we have now a...
before we move on. Yes. So if your experience is like mine, I had a similar initial thought. I thought it was going to be a straight-up action movie. Yeah, it was only like 5 or 6 years after 9/11, so there weren't too many nuanced movies dealing with terrorism yet. So I was definitely expecting an action movie, but quickly settled into sort of a procedural mystery thriller kind of vibe.
Yeah, like a military sort of chess game kind of.
Right.
Like spy versus spy sort of thing. So, in the very beginning, there's an interesting thing that happens that during the terror attack, a sergeant for the police force is the one who disables the vehicle and the terrorist vehicle and kills the terrorist in it. Well, quickly, he is being interrogated, let's say, by the military for maybe being part of the attack. Since he killed the only people that were involved with it that they knew about, and they had police uniforms.
Yeah, so the attackers disguised themselves as police to get onto the compound, which made it more confusing for everybody involved. Yeah, interrogating is a very charitable way of describing. They were beating him, trying to get him to confess to being part of the attack.
So, that already sets up, you've got somebody who you don't know whether he was really involved or not. And he already had, now he's not happy with how he was treated because he beat the crap out of him. But mm-hmm. he is basically rescued from the beating and proven to be at least initially innocent or not guilty by Ferris Al Ghazi.
Al Ghazi, yeah.
Yes. Who is played by Ashraf Barone. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Have you seen him in anything else?
No, but Sandy actually told me about Tyrant. She said it's...
The TV show?
Yeah, she said it's very well worth watching.
Oh.
Except for all the rapey stuff. Like, well, I'm not going to watch this if it's full of rapey stuff, and I got plenty on my list already. But knowing that he's not part of it, I'll totally watch it.
Yeah, I had not heard great things about Tyrant, but yeah, if he's in that.
Yeah, immediately I'll be watching it, because it's, yeah, he's worth searching out. He was my surprise for the movie.
Yeah, and what I really liked about the beginning part of the movie is it cuts back and forth between the intrigue of Jamie Foxx as Agent Fleury and his team are trying to get to Saudi Arabia, because initially the political powers decide not to send over an investigative force because they think it'll cause an increase in tension, and the Saudis don't really want them there anyway. So Jamie Foxx has to sort of finagle his way over there. But they intercut that with what's going on in Saudi Arabia while it's happening. They do such a good job of just fleshing out those characters that in lesser movies would just be so two-dimensional. You see both Al Ghazi and the guy who's getting beaten, Haytham. You see them both at home with their respective families, and both have really tender moments. Haytham with his elderly father, and then Al Ghazi with his wife and kids. They're really brief scenes, but they provide a real humanity to people that, you know, as an American watching the movie, initially I didn't even want, you know, I expected to want them to be just two-dimensional because I didn't want to care about them, but I did.
Initially, they're just going to be part of the group of bad guys, the brown-skinned people.
Yeah, even if they... I guess the typical setup you would expect is even if they're not the terrorists themselves, they're just simply going to be roadblocks to get in the way of and cause conflict with the Americans who are going to turn out to be the big heroes.
Yeah.
Which is not what the movie ends up doing.
So we have Fleury and his group, which they finally managed to get through a little bit of coercion. They get a 5-day pass to be in the compound in Saudi Arabia. And the beginning of the movie does start off with this little cartoon thing about the history of U.S.-Saudi relations. I was looking at it, I'm thinking, well, this is sort of cherry-picked information, and maybe this is just going to be like a propaganda film. But it's true that America and Saudi Arabia have a strange relationship. At least it sets up that initial tension, which I think was good, because then you have the characters, like you said, that you care about, that turns it into a different kind of story.
Right.
So his team turns out to be a forensic examiner, Janet Mays, played by Jennifer Garner, who does a good job. A bomb technician, Grant Sykes, played by Chris Cooper, who I love Chris Cooper.
Academy Award winner Chris Cooper, right?
Yes, absolutely. And also in the movie that Jason and I talked about earlier today, Capote, Chris Cooper.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And then somebody who I didn't expect to be in this movie was intelligence analyst Adam Levitt, Jason Bateman, who starts, yeah. I mean, he's kind of comic relief a little bit. That's what his character is. He's kind of snarky, kind of jokey, not as serious as the rest of the people. This is kind of a typical team, you know, like A-team sort of thing. You've got Jamie Foxx, who's the boss, who's in control of everything. You have Jennifer Garner, who is emotionally involved in it, but she's also very good at her job and tough as nails.
Yeah, she was really close with Kyle Chandler.
Yes.
Agent Manor.
Yeah. In fact, she broke down in the hearing, the briefing that they attended, and Fleury had to whisper something in her ear to calm her down. Anyway, so we got Jennifer Garner as that role. Then you have Chris Cooper as the older agent who's full of wisdom and is fairly serene when things are going bad or difficult around him. And then you have Jason Bateman, who can't stop talking and is something of a pest.
Yeah, the comic relief, though, is also sort of like the whole first part of the movie is a bit of a sleight of hand.
Oh, completely. I thought it was very skillfully done.
Yeah, it still gave me goosebumps watching it, even knowing what was happening.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to watch this movie twice, or did you only watch it once?
I only watched it once. But I will be watching it again, because it's worth a rewatch, most definitely.
Yeah, I recommend it.
So they get to Saudi Arabia, and they meet the Colonel Al-Ghazi, and there's this tension because it's a clash of cultures. They're not allowed to actually touch anything. They're just allowed to observe, and they can only observe during daylight hours, and daylight hours are pretty much what they're told they are. They're otherwise locked in this gymnasium.
Yeah, so it sort of sets up to be a pretty by-the-numbers, fish-out-of-water, have to learn to cooperate with different culture kind of procedural. You know, we talked about the frozen ground a few weeks ago being a pretty by-the-numbers procedural. And this first part of the kingdom could have been the same thing. And maybe it was to some extent, but it executed it so well that even if it was a little bit by the numbers in the beginning, it was still really compelling to watch. And everybody did such a good job playing their individual role that made you care about not only the characters, but what each character had invested in the investigation.
Well, and I mean, this could be, again, I think an episode of the A-Team at this point, too, where,
sure,
you know, you've got, again, a pretty standard setup. I mean, they're not really breaking any new ground. I thought the terrorist attacks was pretty clever. and the way they filmed it was pretty clever and shocking. But otherwise, you're right. It's just, it's sort of paint by numbers at this point, although done really well. And yeah,
you've got the superhero Americans swooping in who just, they know everything. They know how to run investigations better than any of the Saudis. They can just look at stuff and then know what happened. But yeah, and Al Ghazi had such a great line when he was sort of tired of putting up with all the bullshit he was getting from the Americans, and he just sort of went off.
Yeah.
Who's running the investigation?
General Abdelmalek.
He's given us permission to walk through the crime
walk?
Scene.
What? Really?
Yes. Are you kidding me?
Where are you going?
Listen, you're not in charge. I'm going to go find somebody that's in charge so I can get some clarification on what's going on.
Okay, there is nothing to clarify.
Yes, the hell
come
it is.
Back,
if you think
please,
I flew over here 18 hours and you're going to tell us we can walk through, I don't know what kind of game you're playing.
I'm not that guy.
Listen, this is not a game show, Mr. Fool. And definitely there are no deals made here. There is me telling you what you may or may not do,
and there is you doing it. That's it.
You will be permitted to walk through the crime scene when we determine it is safe. That's it. Any questions? By the way, I don't like your jokes.
He's like, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And then he turned to Jason Bateman. He's like, and I don't like your jokes. that felt like just such a genuine and true reaction. It was great. And they gave him that moment so that the American team would have a reason to respect him. And that's sort of that was the start of Agent Fleury, Jamie Foxx, understanding that this is a real guy that he was dealing with who had real police skills, and because of the environment he was in, wasn't able to put them to use. And even though he was acting, he was being a good soldier, he was ultimately just as frustrated as the Americans were that they weren't being able to truly investigate the attack.
And then we have another piece of comic relief. The American treasure, who is Jeremy Piven.
Yeah, it was so weird to see Jeremy Piven just playing a dick.
I know. It's however, will he get back to his Lifetime Channel movies and Hallmark Channel movies? But I don't know. He's Jeremy Piven. He did a great job. He's exactly who you wanted him to be.
Although they sort of gave him the Tom Cruise collateral treatment as far as his appearance went.
Yeah, definitely. I think all the slight over the top. Well, it wasn't slight. It was probably it's regular Jeremy Piven over the top. But he's also playing a politician, a diplomat kind of guy who is basically shaking hands and kissing babies while getting these people the heck out of the country before they cause more problems.
And he hates Saudi Arabia, right? He never says it, but that's the vibe I got. Like, he never wanted to be on the ground. He always sort of came in at 100 miles an hour and did exactly the bare minimum of what he needed to do, and then went right back to the embassy.
Oh yeah, no, he was happy to be in the embassy, but yeah, he didn't want to be driving around in Riyadh. So they, of course, are actually the only reason they get over there is they are basically invited guests of one of the Saudi princes, and he invites them for dinner. And there's some funny falconry, and it's clever piece of work they do, Jamie Foxx and the Prince and Al Ghazi. Basically, they get the opportunity to really look for evidence at this crime scene. So they have what would you call it? It'd be like the CSI montage, where everybody kind of breaks up into what they do best.
Right. Agent Fleury is doing his detecting. Agent Sykes is starting to deconstruct the bomb site. Jennifer Gardner is dealing with the bodies, pulling out pieces of marble.
Child's toy marbles. Glass marbles, yes.
Yes.
and Jax.
Shrapnel.
Yes.
Shrapnel in the bombs.
Yes. And Jax and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And Agent Leavitt is doing his analyzing, which is mostly just giving Agent Sykes a hard time.
Yeah, and Googling.
Right.
He's a mighty Googler. So again, this is all actually sort of paid by numbers too.
Yeah, but very well paced.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I don't have any complaints with this movie so far at all. Actually, during any of it, really. So they conduct an investigation. They turn up some leads. The colonel orders a SWAT team to raid this house. And they manage to find a couple of terrorists and who have a couple of guns.
Kids, basically.
Yeah. So not the big fish they were hoping for. But enough that Jeremy Piven says, oh, you guys are heroes. You've dismantled a terrorist cell, so now go.
All right. They were looking for Abu Hamza,
yes.
the main bomb maker and seemingly the head guy in the absence of Bin Laden.
Yeah, the mastermind behind the
right.
bombing.
Yeah, that's who Agent Fleury and his team really want to get. And Al Ghazi.
Oh, yeah. And Al Hamza, Abu Hamza, is
Abu
yeah,
Hamza.
Is something of a ghost. I mean, he's not seen very often. So finding him would be something of a coup.
He releases videos taking credit, but he's always, his face is mostly obscured.
He's the eventual... he's the kingpin they want to get, and what they end up with is just getting a little small fish. But at this point, they are basically ordered to go in a convoy to the airport to get the hell out of the country. We're done here. We've caused enough problems. We have a nice little soundbite for the news. We can take victory, but we're going home.
Right, and then Fleury and Al Ghazi both know that they didn't get. They didn't get who they needed to get, and they're both talking about how Agent Fleury and his team are likely going to have to come back because there's going to be another attack. You know, and they're having a conversation sort of very, in a resigned manner. They're both frustrated, but no, there's not really anything they can do about it.
Yeah, and they're resigned to the fact that it's too many forces above them are conspiring against them to make this thing work out.
It's that type of, it also sort of is the culmination of their friendship and relationship that they've developed.
During this whole part, they've had a chance to, Fleury and Al Ghazi have talked a lot.
Right.
So they have they respect each other as colleagues as well as.
And as the audience, my experience both times I watched it was, At this point in the movie, really unexpectedly, it did a good job of getting me to view Al Ghazi as an equal to Fleury. They are definitely peers.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Yep. And at this time, you realize that Al Ghazi really is a good guy. But because everybody's in this situation, you know, they may be on opposite side of certain issues, but they're all going for a common goal.
Exactly.
And for different reasons, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, so then, on the way to the airport, they are intercepted by a speeding car and bad guys who are going to take them all out. Do you know anything about the shooting of this film?
I don't.
Okay. Well, they film this on this highway shot outside of, I think, Gilbert, Arizona, or Mesa, Arizona, on this highway that was almost completed but not quite open to the public. So they filmed a lot of this stuff, actually, I think one of the scenes in, the briefing scene may have been in the Gilbert Police Detention Center. And I've got a former coworker friend who actually works in that sort of area, but she said that they were in and out. There wasn't really any stories to tell about that. But the sad part of it is, this is where the prop master was killed in this movie.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think Peter Berg may have even been driving or in the SUV. But the prop master was in this ATV. I don't know if it was like a four-wheeler or more like a dune buggy sort of thing. But it was hit by an SUV and killed during this whole thing. So that was pretty... It kind of brings home that while this highway scene is well done, but yeah, this is dangerous stuff they're doing.
Yeah, I was actually going to credit the movie for its tremendous use of practical effects.
Oh yeah,
there were big set pieces, big explosions as at this point the movie turns into a totally different movie, and not that I could tell, there wasn't any CGI effects. If there were, they're really good effects because it looked real.
Oh no, it looked great. Yeah, I mean it did. It worked. And again, I'm not suggesting that that anybody really did anything wrong. It was just a tragic accident that happened. But it just sort of reminded. It kind of was a little. I didn't know this till after I saw the movie. But I thought, whoa, this is sort of a downer. But yeah, it looks great. I mean, that's why having the ability to find some place where you have a stretch of highway that you can just take over and film at is amazing.
Have you heard anything about the movie Midnight Rider?
Where the girl was killed by the train.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an ugly piece of business.
Yeah, I think William Hurt has walked off the movie, right? Like he's no longer involved.
Yeah, I think at this point you have to be. I mean, I think it's a little Twilight Zone movie situation. Yeah. Because they weren't doing what they should have done, and nobody should have died.
Right. I think the director, maybe the producer, had to turn themselves in to the police.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, ultimately the director is the boss. He's responsible. But most definitely anybody who was shooting that on that scene... Because if I understand correctly, what happened was they were shooting a scene late at night on some train tracks. And they had some, like, permission kind of generally, but they were didn't have specific permission. And they didn't know the timetables or notify any of the railroad dispatch people. And so what was she? Well, I forget what her actual job was. But she was basically had set up a ways down from where they were shooting on these train tracks and got hit by a train and killed. And there were other people who were injured, I believe.
Yeah, I think they were supposed to be shooting near, it was a bridge. And the director, I think, decided while they were on location that the shot would be better if they were actually on the bridge instead of just near it. And so they wanted to just get the shot real quick while they were there instead of taking the time to really do a thorough analysis of the safety of it. They thought that if a train came, they would have, once they saw it coming, they'd have a couple of minutes to get out of the way. But as it turns out, they had less than 60 seconds.
Yeah, and that's...
was not enough time.
No, and that's just, right there. I mean, that's, that would be guilty.
Yes.
I mean, it would be guilty because of negligence. I mean, you're basically being very, very sloppy and putting people's lives in danger. Yeah, which is completely irresponsible. There's no way. I mean, there's no way. And on the other hand, you know, imagine being a small part of that movie or a producer on that movie where you're just screwed at that point. You know, your director has taken this stupid chance. And now all of your investment is gone, you know, whatever you hope to get out of this movie, which ultimately is just a tiny piece of art, has now cost. I mean, you've lost everything and maybe somebody's going to go to jail.
Right.
Very sad. I'm surprised John Landis didn't go to jail, too.
Oh, for the Twilight Zone?
Yeah. Because even though that was accidental, those kids never should have been there. Anyway, very sad.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry for that digression.
No, it's okay. I started off with the tale of woe on the what is otherwise a very spectacular and powerful and effective action scene on the highway. Sadly, a guy got killed. But actually, there was a couple other people that died around the filming of this. But that I think that's just could happen on any job, anytime.
Yeah. On a lighter note, one thing I saw that was kind of fun. In the credits of Frozen, they had a credit to all the babies that were born to crew members during the making of Frozen.
Oh, that's funny.
And it was a significant list.
Sure. Well, that's the thing. I don't know anything about movies other than what I hear on podcasts and read in the occasional book, but you know, these are, I heard a really interesting interview with Guillermo del Toro on The Nerdist, and he was just talking about how, you know, movies take 5, 10, 15 years from conception to actually being out in public, if they ever get out there.
Right.
So, you know, he has lots of great ideas, some of which he may end up doing, but you just never know. So you always have to be working on something. And yeah, that's, I can totally see. I mean, those, I don't know. It's just a whole different, it's like magic. It might as well be magic to me. Cause I mean, can you imagine being like the hair wrangler in an animated film?
No, I mean, yeah, I have no concept of how long it takes to make an animated movie or even do the CGI for a really effects heavy movie. It's going to take so long.
Did you see, this is a super tangent too, and we're actually getting to a good point, but in the kingdom, but we'll tangent off just a little bit more.
Gotta get them out now because there's no going back.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie Skyline?
Skyline.
Or have you seen the movie Battle Los Angeles?
Aaron Eckhart, right?
I think so. In Battle Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the less interesting of the two movies, I think, although that's the main movie.
Yeah, I've seen the beginning 45 minutes and the last 15 of that movie.
Well, what you have in Skyline is basically the guys in charge of the special effects for Battle Los Angeles. I think they basically stole the computer time and made their own movie during the same time they were shooting. Or editing Battle Los Angeles, like with the same computers and everything. And it's Eric Balfour and Donald Faison and some other actors who are basically trapped in a high-rise condo in Los Angeles when like this alien invasion happens.
You had me at Donald Faison and Eric Balfour.
Yeah, well, it's very, it's interesting. It's worth watching, but it's not a great movie, but it's so effects heavy that you can totally see how, you know, if they, these guys could do the effects, they really didn't need much in the way of sets. They already had a lot of it, you know, available to them from the other movie.
the movie's meant to be made together?
Oh, no. I seriously think they stole the time off the one movie to make the other movie, because I think they were sued about it.
That's great.
Isn't it? See, that's the kind of mayhem you should be able to do if you're going to be daring and bold instead of putting people's lives in jeopardy on a fucking train bridge.
Indeed.
Yeah. You know, that's how Marc Maron did his podcast, how he started it. He was fired from Air America, but nobody took his building key.
From Air America?
Yeah, the security badges, because he did a show with Sam Cedar on Air America, the left-wing radio enterprise.
Okay. Sorry, the network, not the movie.
Oh, no. No, not the movie.
I thought Air America way before podcasting.
Yeah, no. As far as I know, Marc Maron never flew to Thailand to do his podcast, but... yeah, when he was fired from Air America, when Air America was just about to go bankrupt anyway, or shutter its doors, they never took his building badges to get into the building. So he and a couple other guys went in there and basically recorded his first 10 or 15 podcasts on Air America radio equipment before he set up his garage. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hey, changed his life, changed podcasting. That's why we're talking and putting it out online right now, pretty much.
Good job, bankrupt left-wing radio network.
Exactly. No, good job, morally bankrupt, bitter comedian for taking advantage of the situation.
What I just heard from you was I would not be on the phone with you right now if it wasn't for Al Gore and Al Franken.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yep, we'd never talk again. It's very sad how that would have happened. But, you know, much like Gwyneth Paltrow movies, it just takes missing one train.
Yeah. So, explosions on the highway.
Yes. Okay, back to the kingdom, because this is where the movie takes a turn. It's explosions on the highway, and they were nearly killed in a terrorist attack. And during the attack, Jason Bateman's character is kidnapped.
Yeah, really... uncomfortably pulled from the vehicle while everyone else is trying to hold on to him.
And from this point on, Jason Bateman's character takes on a whole... This is where the bait and switch happened, where you finally figure out what we've got.
Yeah, this is where the movie turns into a balls-to-the-wall action chase movie. With a ticking clock element to it.
Yes. Oh, most definitely, because the bad guys have put Jason Bateman in a car and are driving him to a place where they're going to execute him in front of a video camera as a captured American. And because they have the ability to give chase after fighting off the people that the terrorist guys that stopped him in the first place, the team now has to go rescue Jason Bateman through the streets of Riyadh.
Into the bad part of town.
And we've already, by the way, in this movie, we have already visited the non-encampment area of Riyadh with our team, and they're not welcome with open arms.
No. It's like when Herc goes to the towers after hours by himself in the wire. It's just not a good idea.
Yeah, never.
But yeah, so all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you're in the climax of a fantastic action movie, and it's going a million miles an hour. It's done really well, and it does everything just perfectly.
All the tension is perfect. Because you've got the Jason Bateman character, who you've been annoyed with for being like basically the pesky younger brother, pain in the ass guy, quipping jokes, who now is in real peril. And you've got the team that's going after him with no help.
He's the computer guy, so he's the one that researches all of the websites that the terrorist organization puts up when they bomb and behead people. So he knows exactly what is going to happen.
Yeah, plus he's the computer guy. He's not the military ass-kicking guy.
Right, but what I really loved about his sequence at the end of the movie, and it's something you don't see very often in hostage situations in movies, he never stopped fighting. It was great. I mean, I didn't realize at the time that nobody who is kidnapped in the movie tries to fight. But maybe it's because he knows what is coming. He never stops fighting. He's always trying to be a nuisance to his captors in some manner or another, even though every time he does, they just wail on him some more.
Well, it's good advice. Since we both have daughters, we will be teaching our daughters fairly soon that you are to stand your ground. You are never going to be, never let yourself be taken to a second location.
Exactly.
Whatever you have to do, do not get into any kind of conveyance with a stranger and fight like hell the entire way, which, you know.
Exactly what Levitt did.
Yes, exactly. And as I suppose luck would have it, or to further the plot of the movie, they actually effect a rescue. And
right. So they end up tracking the vehicle that he's in to a building. And he's taken into a building, and now our team of protagonists have to infiltrate the building and find him before they have a chance to execute him on camera.
Which, as it's described, isn't going to really take very long.
No, in one of the cuts to Levitt, as they're about to film his death, one of the ways he fights is he's smart enough to realize that he should kick the tripod out from the camera and try and damage it. That ends up, because they don't want to kill him unless they can get some propaganda out of it. So that actually buys them a few minutes as they try and get the camera set back up and make sure it's functioning. So that was really smart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it was just enough of, like, real-world problems that could happen that it didn't feel like it wasn't a cheat.
Right. It's not like he kicked the tripod out and all of a sudden the camera exploded. They were getting it right back up, and they were going to go right back to business. But
oh yeah, and they took it off the tripod and everything, so he wouldn't be able to do it again. And it's not—I mean, you know—all it would have taken is a little yakety sax or wah wah when the camera fell over. But no, this is not what this movie is about. So when they're going door to door in this building. I mean, after they have a fight in the street, so we go from a battle in the highway to a chase to a battle in an alley to a door-to-door inside a building rescue mission.
Yeah, and so it's Fleury, Al-Ghazi, and Jennifer Garner, I forget her character's name, are the ones infiltrating the building, while Sykes and Haytham are left out to fend off the masses out in the courtyard, which just felt like the beginning of Black Hawk Down.
Oh, exactly.
Out there.
Yeah, very reminiscent of Black Hawk Down. And so we have the room-to-room fighting in the building, and they rescue Levitt, but they still have to get out of this building.
Jennifer Garner actually finds him, and in a really harrowing scene, she sees them through a hole in the floor just as they're getting ready to execute him, and shoots the executor and the cameraman before realizing that there's another man beneath her who grabs her, and then she ends up with some hand-to-hand combat with some help from Levitt, eventually subduing him. But really uncomfortable and brutal scene to watch.
Well done, though.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like a genuine fight. I mean, he's thrown her around,
and then we get to, well, it's not really the end of the movie, but I thought it was going to be the end of the movie.
But yeah, once they rescue Levitt and they've killed a bunch of terrorists inside the building, and no one's shooting at them anymore, they go to one of the apartments to try and figure out how to get out, knowing that they got to get out quickly. But in one of the most spine-tinglingly chilling scenes, they leave Levitt out in the hallway by himself.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I think his adrenaline rush is, I think, starting to wane. So he's spent. So he's just kind of sitting in the hallway, but he's by himself. I 100% thought he was dead. I thought he was going to die.
Well, yeah, because he wasn't even armed at that point. He was just literally like flopped down, sitting down, leaning against a wall in the apartment, or in the hallway.
Yeah, if I'd been one of those people who shouted at the screen, I would have been yelling, why are you leaving him by himself in the hallway? But I'm not, so I just thought it really loudly.
So then, this apartment that they're in, Jennifer Garner, whose character, one of her traits is she's always sucking on a lollipop, so she gives a little girl a lollipop, the little girl hands her a marble, and bing, lights are on. similar. It's very similar to the marble that was found in the shrapnel. And then there's a trail of blood in the apartment that leads to the back. And then Al-Ghazi sees the grandfather and asks the man to help him up so he can get a look at his hand, because we've already established this point through a scene we didn't talk about, that bombers usually are missing fingers. So the grandfather in this little apartment... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and Al-Ghazi was checking the bodies of the house that they had sacked earlier. He was checking the bodies for missing hands on the... I always get this mixed up. His right hand? Because they'd seen on video of Abu Hamza that he was missing his index and middle finger on his right hand. So Al-Ghazi is checking all the hands of the bodies to see if any of them were Abu Hamza before all this happened. So yeah, when he offers to help the old man up and sees that he's missing two fingers on his right hand, he introduces himself to Abu Hamza.
And then the jig is up, and unfortunately, Abu Hamza's teenage grandson walks out of the bedroom and shoots Al-Ghazi in the neck twice with a pistol. And then he points his gun at Maze, and then, I guess it was jammed, but he points a gun at Maze, and Flurry shot the grandson. And then Abu Hamza pulls out an assault rifle, but Haytham shoots him in the chest. So, bad guy killed. One of our good guys is dying. Credits roll, right?
Nope.
See, this is where this turned into a third kind of movie.
Yeah, I could have done without the... Actually, yeah. No, I mean, I get what they're trying to do. I think they just pounded it home a little too hard. I think they could have shown the parallel without having the actual... Not dialogue, but dueling monologues.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I thought this... I was not expecting it.
No, at this point, I wasn't expecting anything.
So, what we end up with is Al-Ghazi dies in Flurry's arms, and Flurry and Haytham go to Al-Ghazi's house, and Flurry tells Al-Ghazi's son that he was his good friend, and it's all very touching, and you think that that's where... And then they all go back to... the team goes back to America, and they meet with the FBI director, who's played by Richard Jenkins, who's awesome, of course. But the last scene of the movie, because when Abu Hamza, as he was dying, I guess that his grandson or a different grandson goes close to him, and there's something whispered in his ear by Abu Hamza. So at the very end, we have a scene where Levitt asked Flurry what the hell he had whispered into Maze's ear in the very beginning in the briefing to calm her down, because she, over the death of the other agent. And at the same time, we have the mother of this child asking what his grandfather had whispered to him as he was dying, and it turns out they were the same words.
Flurry, tell me what you whispered to Janet in the briefing to get her to stop crying about Fran, before all this, before we even got airborne. What'd you say to her?
علمني وانا عمتك وش همس باذنك جدي قبل ما يقتلوه.
Remember? I told her we were going to kill them all.
So now we have a moral message in the whole movie.
Right. I think that part didn't need to be so explicit. I think the movie had laid enough track to get us there without them really having to spell it out for us.
Did you happen to see the trivia about an earlier draft of the script with a different ending?
No.
Here's what the alternate ending would have been. A much worse ending, as far as I'm concerned. Because an earlier draft... One of the things that was powerful about this movie is that Haytham, the sergeant in the Saudi military who got his ass kicked during the interrogation, he's one of the good guys. So, it kind of shows the brutality of the regime.
Yeah, while the general is turning his ear into hamburger, he is professing himself to be a patriot.
Exactly. Yeah, and he even says later to Al-Ghazi that he would do anything for his country, and it's a little disheartening to get your ass kicked. Yeah, his ear is hamburger for the entire movie. Mm-hmm. But I guess an earlier draft of the script had Haytham being disaffected after being tortured by his own government and for his suspected involvement in the bombings. The earlier ending had Al-Ghazi surviving, but instead Haytham says goodbye to the FBI team at the airbase with a hidden bomb strapped to his chest. Mm-hmm. And Sykes tackles Haytham away from the group, but Haytham detonates it before Sykes can get clear.
That's terrible.
Isn't it? That would have been a horrible ending to it.
That potentially would have ruined the entire movie.
It would have. Absolutely. Yeah, because then that would have been the all brown people are bad movie right there to the beginning.
Oh, that's
so that's
awful.
Good. I mean, again, and yeah. I was listening to another podcast that I love a great deal, the Horror Etc. podcast. I had gone back and was listening to some of their very early episodes, and Ted, the guy who basically does the trivia research, and he takes probably more of the notes from the two guys. He's like, he discounts anything IMDb trivia wise. He's like, these are just written by IMDb people, and you have no idea whether they're true or not. So I have to throw a little bit of that in there, that who knows how true this is. Although I would believe that an earlier draft of the script could call for that.
That's very hacky.
And you're right, the whole point of the thing, although the end, I guess I can see it's sort of heavy-handed, although, like I said, I wasn't expecting it, so I kind of liked the hook at the end about how, oh crap, now I got to think about this movie. Before, it was like sort of it turned from a procedural to a kind of a chase movie with a bittersweet but feel-good ending. And then at the very end, you've got Fleury now is just... I mean, his character is now just as bad as the rest of them. Eye for an eye, whole world blind, that kind of thing.
Right.
Or it's this hatred that, or reaction that is why this is still going on.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good ending. It's a little too much hand-holding. I think the movie had done such a great job of showing the audience a lot of respect and had high expectations for the audience to keep up with the movie. And then at the very end, it just really walks us down the path instead of just kind of showing and suggesting and trusting us to get it.
Well, but I'm going to suggest that had it ended just prior to that scene, had it ended with basically the last piece of the action or the last piece of the puzzle being when Fleury goes to Al-Ghazi's house and talks to his son, it would have been a fine place to end the movie. But you would have been left with a different message. The message in that case that I would have taken out of it, at least, would have been that, oh, Al-Ghazi's son is just the same as Special Agent Manner's son. So we all have common interest. But when they added the second part to it, the last part, because I don't think I would have got to the point where, oh yeah, we not only have common interest, but we have common hatred without that handholding, without that scene. I guess they could have done it with just Fleury telling what he said to Maze at the end without the Abu Hamza. I don't know. I don't know what else could have been done.
I think just cutting to Abu Hamza's family and showing them mourning him, I think would have conveyed the same message.
No, I'm going to argue that it's not the mourning. It's not the fact that we all mourn our dead. It's the fact that we all want revenge.
Sure, but if you show the family mourning and maybe with a sinister kind of zoom in to the kid, I think you still could have gotten there.
Yeah, maybe. I don't have to, though, now, because they gave it to me, so it was fine. But no, while I was watching this movie, especially that first part, I thought it was very good, but I'm like, why does Drew want me to watch this movie? What's so special about this movie? And then immediately then I was sort of lost in the story, and it was fun. It was great. And yeah, I think the actor who plays Al-Ghazi is definitely worth watching. Anything he's in, I want to see.
That's funny. So anytime I recommend a movie to you with limited information, are you wondering what the ulterior motive is?
No, it's not necessarily ulterior motive, but it's sort of like Collateral. You know, since I hadn't seen it, I have no preparation for it, but I know we're going to talk about it for the podcast. I'm thinking, well, okay, Drew, there's something about this movie that Drew wants to talk about. I wonder what that is. So in the back of my mind, I have to I guess I should avoid trying to unravel that mystery as I'm watching a movie, because I should just be watching the movie.
No, I like it. I'll have to throw you a curveball.
Yeah. Well, no, but I never know when the curveball is coming. That's the thing. Good or bad. I mean, you're not going to pick them. I mean, I'm guessing that you're not going to pick a movie you don't feel anything about.
Maybe I'll throw a Source Code at you.
Don't do that.
Just to see if you can predict. What is it about this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I like Lea Thompson, but Howard the Duck, it's got some problems to it. Anyway, so other thoughts about The Kingdom?
No, I was so happy to rewatch it. It was even better than I expected it to be the second time around.
Yeah.
So I recommend anybody to watch it. It's two movies in one.
It is. And two good movies, you know, they're both well done.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think it actually treats everybody, it does, although, again, the hand-holding thing we're going to have to disagree about, but I think it shows respect for all of the characters in the movie.
After watching this movie, I was all in on Peter Berg. I thought, I will watch anything that Peter Berg makes because this movie was so great. It turns out that's not quite true, but...
Okay, hold on. So I know Peter Berg has been an actor in a bunch of stuff, including Collateral, but he, Lone Survivor, is that what he did most recently?
Yeah, he did a movie before Lone Survivor, Battleship.
See, I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either because it looks terrible.
Well, yeah, it does look terrible. Although, again... See, that's the thing. I was talking to our mom about this, about movies and even watching back, because we were talking a little bit about The Frozen Ground and criticizing it. I'm like, you know, on one hand, you know, I mean, I have no problem picking apart movies because, you know, obviously there are good parts in movies and bad parts in movies, and I'm happy to talk about them because I like watching really good movies. But at some point, you know, every single movie that's out there, somebody thought was going to be a good movie. Whenever I, especially horror movies, since I watch so many bad horror movies, I try to put on the cap of looking for, you know, is it a bad movie because this person just wasn't able to accomplish their vision with the talent that they have, either themselves or their actors, or was this, you know, just a bad script and a way to try to show off your talent to get money for your next movie? Or, you know, why is this movie? Why did somebody pay a bunch of money for this movie and then pay a bunch of money to distribute this movie?
Very true.
But it doesn't always work that well.
Yeah, the movie that Peter Berg did directly after The Kingdom was Hancock. Did you ever see that one?
No, I've heard that's two movies in one also.
Yeah, that, yes, but not in a good way.
Mm.
It's like a good movie that turns into a terrible movie. But it started out with such promise. I haven't sold my Peter Berg stock, but I might be regretting buying so much.
Well, yeah, hopefully... Ashraf Barum doesn't disappoint us. It's funny, in a strange, you know, looking at the IMDb credits of the actors and the bios, both Haytham and Al-Ghazi are played by Israelis.
Really?
Yeah, Al-Ghazi his family is Arabian. I mean, he's of Arabian descent, but he, you know, he was born and raised in Israel and, you know, went to college there. And then Ali Suleiman, who plays, or Ali Suleiman.
So he's an Arab Israeli.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then Haytham, I don't know whether he has, if he's an Arab Israeli, but he's definitely also an Israeli. Or at least he went to school and acting school in Israel. I think he was born in Israel too. Both of them were, if I remember correctly. Which is only funny because, you know, one of the things that makes the Levitt character interesting is that, you know, he's the Jew or the person at least who has family in Israel. And they made a big, he shouldn't even be allowed in the country because of that.
Yes, they were scrutinizing his passport because he had been to Israel.
Yeah. And you got the sense that he wasn't going to be let off the plane if he was traveling commercially in that situation. Right. But hey, you know, they did great jobs.
Yeah. One last question about the kingdom. Is this the best you've ever seen Jason Bateman in a movie?
Yeah.
After watching this, every time I see Jason Bateman, even when he is enjoyable, as he is in Arrested Development, it always makes me feel like he is just leaving too much on the table. Like he is not fulfilling his potential.
I think Jason Bateman was one of those guys that I didn't want to like. And I don't know why. I mean, it was obviously from, maybe I thought he was just like the poor man's Michael J. Fox.
Interesting.
Yeah, or the Jeremy Piven Jr. I don't know. I got a sense of smarm. But that was way back when I was super judgmental and young. Now I'm super judgmental and old, so it's a different deal. Next week's movie?
Lay it on me.
Well, okay. On your list, there's a movie called The Apartment. Yeah. You want to do that?
Sure. We're talking Jack Lemmon, right?
I believe so. I'm not sure if I've ever seen it. I mean, I have it. You know, I've been trying to... I'm getting stuff from your list and Jason's list and trying to keep them on heavy rotation or going through the Netflix queue. Yeah, I was surprised to see the movie because it's, again, it's an older movie and it's one that I don't remember actually watching. But if it's on your list, I want to watch it.
Yeah, no, I'm just making sure we're talking about the same movie.
Yeah, no, me too. Yeah. I think there's either a Japanese or a Korean horror movie called The Apartment, and I assume that wasn't the one you were.
No. Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon. For sure.
All right. Got your walkout line from The Kingdom?
I do, but you already said it, so.
Oh, no.
I should have known.
You weren't going to say we're going to kill them all, were you?
Yeah.
Oh, don't do that. That's what left us in this trouble.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be there. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.